Hello, and welcome to today's News in Perspective. I'm Virginia Voice volunteer Charlie Winnegal, reading opinions from syndicated columnists, editorials from national newspapers and magazines, and views from experts in their fields. I'll read for about a half an hour, and another reader will finish the program with the second half hour. Today's first article: African drone company uses AI to give vital help to U.S. fruit and nut farmers, by Paul Tinsley, Fox News. Johannesburg. South Africa's Aerobotics is utilizing artificial intelligence in helping fruit and nut farmers improve crop yields. Although the Cape Town-based company only started 9 years ago, it is already operating in 18 countries, with the U.S. being their largest market, followed by South Africa, Australia, Spain, and Portugal. Its customers produce tens of millions of tons of fresh produce every year. California is now ground zero for Aerobotics, where the company has the biggest concentration of customers. On its 76,000 farms and ranches, sources agree the state produces more than half of all fruit and vegetables grown in the U.S. The California Climate and Agriculture Network recently warned in a statement that, depending on the weather and water availability, the state has much to lose if the worst impacts of climate change on agriculture are not avoided. This, which is where Aerobotics has stepped in, using AI to reverse these trends by almost miraculously helping directly to increase not just the amount of produce grown, but also utilize the dwindling water resources more efficiently. Food security is a global challenge, and everyone is being challenged to do more with less. Using the latest AI and different imagery sources, Aerobotics help the fruit and nut industry make better decisions and improve yields, the company's CEO James Patterson told Fox News Digital. He continued, "We work with a range of fruit and nut producers across the U.S., from citrus and table grape growers in California, to apple producers in Washington, to nut growers in Arizona and New Mexico. We have mapped over 600,000 acres of farmland in the U.S., and growers are uploading over 1 million images of fruit per month through our platform, using our system to scale their knowledge." Patterson, who operates from offices in Cape Town and California, grew up on a fruit farm in South Africa, witnessing firsthand the harsh risk involved in fruit production. "This planted the proverbial seed to find a way to use data to improve operations and knowledge." He worked on cutting-edge AI and drone technologies when pursuing a master's degree at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, learning how to address agricultural challenges, and then teamed up with Benji Meltzer, an expert in computer vision and software system, to found the now 60-strong Aerobotics team. The Portugal balcony, favored by farmers worldwide in South Africa, is known as a stoop. Patterson probably claimed is farming from a stoop, as when using drones, the farmer can evaluate his produce from his armchair. In this case, AI can perhaps be accused of thinking, as the Aerobotics software in AWS or Amazon Web Services servers, it feeds data and images to use this information to report on the health and status of fruit and predict crop yields. The information receives helps planning for pack houses, sales teams, and retailers. And it saves huge amounts of time, lopping off hours off chores such as checking out pesky insects. AWS claimed in a statement that the AI system has cut down monitoring every tree for pest and disease on a 50-hectare farm from an ordinary day to just 20 minutes. Imagery is analyzed by AI models to detect individual fruits and calculate various matrix, including size, color, and external quality of blemishes, Patterson told Fox News Digital. This data undergoes analysis through hyper-localized forecasting models to project the data forward to harvest. As data accumulates on a farm, the models are fine-tuned to that specific environment. Essentially, the AI models learn and adapt to localized growing conditions, enhancing forecasting accuracy, and enable comparisons to previous years, Patterson added. Another AI product produces a digital model of each tree on the farm at scale, tracking it over time. Each tree is conceptualized as a factory that can be optimized to produce the highest quality fruit. Data is gathered by drones equipped with thermal and multispectral cameras operated either by the grower or through a third-party pilot network, added Patterson. In this increasingly water-scarce world, the Aerobotics AI also detects irrigation issues such as leaks, pressure problems, and blocked water lines or pipes. The software assists with fertilizer usage and replanted damaged or missing trees. Typically, when farmers lose a tree, perhaps through disease, they have to wait 5 or 6 years for a new tree to start fully producing. But with this AI, early prediction is possible, ensuring farmers get back into production within a year. U.S. food security is also improved as the AI utilizes per-tree data to determine crop insurance policies and safeguard growers' production. This data-driven approach helps in the production of high-value fruit, including citrus, apples, grapes, cherries, kiwis, table grapes, and pomegranates, and nuts such as almonds, pecans, and pistachios. We started using drone imaging to monitor tree health in our orchards, Aerobotics customer Matt Hall Red of Arizona's North Bowie Farming, a pecan nut producer, told Fox News Digital. As a result of looking at the drone images, we could see which blocks had lower health ratings and apply treatments over time. Multiple flights over time show these blocks health catching up to the control blocks after intervention. The drone flights help us measure this across hundreds of acres, not just one small block. Seeing the improvement in the health uniformity of our blocks is what really sold me on the technology. AI plays a pivotal role in our business and to our customers. Aerobotics, Patterson concluded, AI enables us to construct models that generalize, learn, and operate effectively at scale. Using AI and imagery, we are also able to increase efficiency of data collection by more than 10 times. And that concludes. African Drone Company uses AI to give vital help to U.S. fruit and nut farmers, by Paul Tisley, Fox News. Our next article, we have got to get shovels in the ground. Council plays ball on stadium bond plan, by Jonathan Spears, RichmondBizSense.com. Administrators pitch to change the city's approach to financing its massive Diamond District development appeared to land receptively with Richmond City Council on Monday. Council members expressed support for the plan to have the city issue its own lower interest revenue bonds to fund the project's anchor ballpark for the Richmond Flying Squirrels and initial infrastructure improvements. Doing so is expected to save $215 million in debt costs over the previous plan to issue the bonds through a community development authority. While the city would be responsible for any downside on the debt under the new plan, council members agreed that the risk is outweighed by the project's benefits and chances for success. Given the parties involved and the momentum of the Scott's Addition area it's in, I really feel like this is a good option for us to move forward on, because starting over would be a nightmare, Council President Christine Nye said following administrator's presentation. I do not love using the city's financial backing on the project. However, to me, with the community support, with the squirrels being as popular as they are, and with their housing needs and all the housing that this project is going to be, to me, this is a calculated risk, I said. In addition to reducing the debt cost by a third, from $314 million with the CDA approach to $110 million over the 30-year bond terms, issuing its own bonds allows the city to secure them sooner. That would make them eligible for a state sales tax incentive program that's expected to provide $24 million for the project. The city says it can secure the bonds in June before the program's anticipated July 1 sunset. The change in strategy appears to be revving up a project that's been relatively quiet over the past year, with needed steps such as the CDA's creation yet to be completed. The city is aiming to break ground on the new ballpark in June and complete it in time for the 2026 season to comply with facility standards for pro baseball venues that cannot be met with the existing Diamond Stadium. The new approach was welcomed by executives with the Flying Squirrels Ball Club and Minor League Baseball, who lauded the move in a release put out by the city. Today's announcement by the city represents an important step toward ensuring that the Squirrels will have a new home in Richmond, Flying Squirrels President Lou DiBella said in his release. April 2026 is just around the corner, so it's imperative that all stakeholders move forward collectively and with a sense of urgency, added Morgan Sword, Executive Vice President for Baseball Operations for MILB. Richmond has been a great market for minor league baseball, and we're excited to see that the city is making progress on putting in place a plan to keep baseball in Richmond for years to come. We think today's developments are an important step forward to ensuring that the new stadium will be ready in time for the 2026 season. With the bonds secured in June, the city would sell the land to the developers for the project's first phase, part of which grown in size during the design phase along with the new ballpark. Deputy Chief Administrative Officer Sharon Ebert said Monday that the planned footprint for the 10,000-seat ballpark has been increased to allow more parking for the team and the 360-degree fan experience sought by the Squirrels. She said an adjacent Central Park that would serve the larger development is now planned to drop in size from 11 acres to 8. Current design also would allow for more residential units, which along with retail development and a 180-room hotel would support the stadium by generating tax revenue that would pay for the bonds through a tax increment financing approach. Total investment in the first phase is projected at $627 million. With a CDA no longer needed, the new approach would also free up adjacent taxable properties that had been planned to be included in the CDA. TIF District, which had been expanded beyond the 67 acres that make up the project site. Under the new plan, those surrounding properties would continue to generate taxes for general city services. The city said issuing the bonds would not impact the debt capacity and would free up nearly $24 million of debt capacity that had been programmed for the infrastructure improvement. Ebert emphasized that assuming the bond debt would not affect the city's ability to issue bonds for other capital improvement projects, such as schools. This is much more cost-effective, said Ebert, who also addressed the risk to the city should the project fail to produce the projected revenue. There is risk. I don't want to say that there isn't any risk, she said. Taking this approach does require the city to put its full faith and credit behind the bond if the tax revenues don't materialize as expected. Such a scenario would put the city on the hook for $7 million in annual debt payments, Ebert said. But with Flying Squirrels' attendance expected to increase, with the involvement of a known developer and Tallhammer Realty Partners, and with the Scott's Addition area expected to keep booming, she added, it is with confidence that we are recommending that we should put the city's full faith and credit behind these city-issued special revenue bonds. Ebert acknowledged the tight time frame faced by the city, caused in part by the upheaval in capital markets from the rapid rise in interest rates since the project was first proposed. The reason why it's taken us so long has been the economic climate over last year. It was never ending trying to catch up with the inflation and how we were going to deal with that, but we are now prepared to move forward. Ordinances reflecting the new finance approach, as well as changes to the development team led by Todd Hamos and Loop Capital, were introduced at Council's regular meeting Monday and are to be voted on at an upcoming meeting. Councilwoman Ann Francis Lambert questioned various details about the project and the new agreements, including whether previous agreements with Republic Properties, which had led to the development team but is not involved in a new entity with Tall Hammer and Loop, have been resolved. Councilwoman Catherine Jordan, whose district includes the Diamond District site, lauded the project's design and progress to this point, noting Tall Hammer's involvement on the local level. One of the reasons among many that we went with the Tall Hammer team was because they were going to be twists and turns that we were not going to be able to forecast, and I believe strongly that when you have a local partner, they just have so much buy-in and commitment to seeing it through despite what challenges might come along, Jordan said. We have got to get shovels in the ground, she added. It's very concerning that the sales tax was going to sunset and we've made a commitment to build this ballpark on a deadline that was imposed to us that we're already really on the edge of. And that concludes, we have got to get shovels in the ground. Council plays ball on stadium bond plan by Jonathan Spears, Richmond Business. Our next article, unusual object found in backyard of Stanton home, by Olivia Whitehouse, WHSV.com. Stanton, Virginia. Stanton Fire and Rescue responded to an unusual call for a possible cannonball found in the yard of a home on West Frederick Street. The object was discovered by landscapers working in the yard of the home. Real estate agent Jason Singh, whose Innovation Properties, said when the object was discovered, they thought it was a rock. This feels way too heavy to be a rock, and one of them ended up rinsing it off, and we saw that it was a metal ball, and as soon as I saw that, I thought, oh my God, this is a cannonball, said Singh. Singh said this is not the first time he has been in this situation, and having been in a similar situation, had a better idea of the protocol that should be taken. I had something similar actually happen up in Front Royal, and so that is why I was kind of a bit more familiar with what to kind of do, and I'm thankful that I have some of that experience, said Singh. Perry Weller, Deputy Chief of Community Risk Reduction with Stanton Fire and Rescue, said this happened on Monday, April 8th, and Stanton Fire Rescue called Virginia State Police to dispose of the object. We assumed it was a Civil War cannonball because it can be very unstable, so it was a live ordnance, said Weller. Weller said, if you find something unusual in the ground, leave it alone. Don't pick it up. Don't toss it around. Call us and we'll get the proper authorities there to dispose of it, said Weller. It is possible for others to be in the city that have not been discovered yet, said Weller. In the last couple of years, this is the second one that I can recall that has been discovered and we have to call the Virginia State Police to assist with, said Weller. Weller said, if you find something odd in your yard, to call the authorities so that they can come and take a look at it and to determine if it needed to be disposed of. And that concludes Unusual Object Found in Backyard of Stanton Home by Olivia Whitehouse, WHSV.com. Our next article, not science fiction, Harvard scientists have developed an intelligent liquid from the Harvard John A. Paulson School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. Harvard researchers have created a versatile, programmable metal fluid that can change its properties, including viscosity and optical transparency, in response to pressure. This new class of fluid has potential applications in robotics, optical devices, and energy dissipation, showcasing a significant breakthrough in metal material technology. Scientists at the Harvard John A. Paulson School of Engineering and Applied Sciences have developed a programmable metal fluid with tunable springiness, optical properties, viscosity, and even the ability to transition between a Newtonian and non-Newtonian fluid. The first of its kind, MetaFluid, uses a suspension of small elastomer spheres between 50 to 500 microns that buckle under pressure, radically changing the characteristics of the fluid. The MetaFluid could be used in everything from hydraulic actuators to program robots to intelligent shock absorbers that can dissipate energy depending on the intensity of the impact, to optical devices that can transition from clear to opaque. The research is published in Nature. We just scratched the surface of what is possible with this new class of fluid, said Adele DeJulli, a research associate in material science and mechanical engineering at SEAS, and first author of the paper. With this one platform, you could do so many different things in so many different fields. Metamaterials, artificially engineered materials whose properties are determined by their structure rather than composition, have been widely used in a range of applications for years. But most of the materials, such as the metal knees pioneered in the lab of Federico Capasso, Robert L. Wallace Professor of Applied Science, and Vinton Hayes, Senior Research Fellow in Electrical Engineers at SEAS, are solid. Turnable optics with a Harvard logo displayed below the MetaFluid. Unlike solid metamaterials, metamaterials have the unique ability to flow and adapt to the shape of their container, said Katie Abertoli, William and Annie Kwan, Dana Professor of Applied Mechanics at SEAS, and senior author of the paper. Our goal was to create a metafluid that not even possesses these remarkable attributes, but also provides a platform for programmable viscosity, comprehensibility, and optical properties. Using a highly scalable fabrication technique developed in the lab of David A. Waits, Mallinckrodt Professor of Physics and of Applied Physics at SEA, the research team produced hundreds of thousands of these highly deformable spherical capsules filled with air and suspended them in silicon oil. When the pressure inside the liquid increases, the capsule collapses, forming a lens-like half sphere. When that pressure is removed, the capsules pop back into their spherical shape. The metafluid also changes its optical properties when exposed to changing pressures. When the capsules are round, they scatter light, making the liquid opaque, much like air bubbles make aerated water pure white. But when pressure is applied and the capsules collapse, they act like microlenses, focusing light and making the liquid transparent. These optical products could be used for a range of applications, such as e-inks that change color based on pressure. The researchers also showed that when the capsules are spherical, the metafluid behaves like a Newtonian fluid, meaning its viscosity only changes in response to temperatures. However, when the capsules are collapsed, the suspension transforms into non-Newtonian fluid, meaning that its viscosity will change in response to shear force. The greater the shear force, the more fluid it becomes. This is the first metafluid that has shown to transition between Newtonian and non-Newtonian states. Next, the researchers aim to explore the acoustic and thermodynamic properties of the metafluid. This application space for these scalable, easy-to-produce metafluids is huge, said Bertoldi. And that concludes, not science fiction, Harvard scientists have developed an intelligent liquid from the Harvard John A. Paulson School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. That concludes our first half hour of today's News and Perspective. I'm Charlie Wonigle for Virginia Voice.
Hello, I'm Ross Bowers, reading the second half of today's News and Perspective. First article comes from the New York Times. The Math on Ukraine Doesn't Add Up by J.D. Vance, April 12, 2024. Mr. Vance, a Republican, is the junior senator from Ohio. President Biden wants the world to believe that the biggest obstacle facing Ukraine is Republicans and our lack of commitment to the global community. This is wrong. Ukraine's challenge is not the GOP, it's math. Ukraine needs more soldiers than it can field, even with draconian conscription policies, and it needs more materiel than the United States can provide. This reality must inform any future Ukraine policy, from further congressional aid to the diplomatic course set by the president. The Biden administration has applied increasing pressure on Republicans to pass a supplemental aid package of more than $60 billion to Ukraine. I voted against this package in the Senate and remain opposed to virtually any proposal for the United States to continue funding this war. Mr. Biden has failed to articulate even basic facts about what Ukraine needs and how this aid will change the reality on the ground. The most fundamental question, how much does Ukraine need and how much can we actually provide? Mr. Biden suggests that a $60 billion supplemental means the difference between victory and defeat in a major war between Russia and Ukraine. That is also wrong. $60 billion is a fraction of what it would take to turn the tide in Ukraine's favor. But this is not just a matter of dollars. Fundamentally, we lack the capacity to manufacture the amount of weapons Ukraine needs us to supply to win the war. Consider our ability to produce 155mm artillery shells. Last year, Ukraine's then defense minister assessed that their baseline requirement for these shells is over 4 million per year, but said they could fire up to 7 million if that many were available. Since the start of the conflict, the United States has gone to great lengths to ramp up production of 155mm shells. We've roughly doubled our capacity and can now produce 360,000 per year, less than a tenth of what Ukraine needs, it says it needs. The administration's goal is to get this to 1.2 million, 30% of what's needed, by the end of 2025. This would cost the American taxpayers dearly, while yielding an unpleasantly familiar result, failure abroad. Just this week, the top American military commander in Europe argued that absent further security assistance, Russia could soon have a 10-to-1 artillery advantage over Ukraine. What didn't gather as many headlines is that Russia's current advantage is at least 5-to-1, even after all the money we have poured into the conflict. Neither of these ratios plausibly lead to Ukrainian victory. Proponents of American aid to Ukraine have argued that our approach has been a boon to our own economy, creating jobs here in the factories that manufacture weapons. But our national security interests can be, and often are, separate from our economic interests. The notion that we should prolong a bloody and gruesome war because it's been good for American business is grotesque. We can and should rebuild our industrial base without shipping its products to a foreign conflict. The story is the same when we look at other munitions. Take the Patriot missile system, our premier air defense weapon. It's of such importance in this war that Ukraine's foreign minister has specifically demanded them. That's because in March alone, Russia reportedly launched over 3,000 guided aerial bombs, 600 drones, and 400 missiles at Ukraine. To fend off these attacks, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and others have indicated they need thousands of Patriot interceptors per year. The problem is this. The United States only manufactures 550 every year. If we pass the supplemental aid package currently being considered in Congress, we could potentially increase annual production to 650. But that's still less than a third of what Ukraine requires. These weapons are not only needed by Ukraine. If China were to set its sights on Taiwan, the Patriot missile system would be critical to its defense. In fact, the United States has promised to send Taiwan nearly $900 million worth of Patriot missiles, but delivery of those weapons and other essential resources has been severely delayed, partly because of shortages caused by the war. If that sounds bad, Ukraine's manpower situation is even worse. Here are the basics. Russia has nearly four times the population of Ukraine. Ukraine needs upward of 500,000 new recruits, but hundreds of thousands of fighting-age men have already fled the country. The average Ukrainian soldier is roughly 43 years old, and many soldiers have already served 2 years at the front with few, if any, opportunities to stop fighting. After 2 years of conflict, there are some villages with almost no men left. The Ukrainian military has resorted to coercing men into service, and women have staged protests to demand the return of their husbands and fathers after long years of service at the front. This newspaper reported one instance in which the Ukrainian military attempted to conscript a man with diagnosed mental disability. Many in Washington seem to think that hundreds of thousands of young Ukrainians have gone to war with a song in their heart and are happy to label any thought to the contrary Russian propaganda. But major newspapers on both sides of the Atlantic are reporting that this situation on the ground in Ukraine is grim. These basic mathematical realities were true, but contestable at the outset of the war. They were obvious and incontestable a year ago when American leadership worked closely with Mr. Zelensky to undertake a disastrous counteroffensive. The bad news is that accepting brute reality would have been most useful last spring, before the Ukrainians launched that extremely costly and unsuccessful military campaign. The good news is that even now a defensive strategy can work. Digging in with old-fashioned ditches, cement, and landmines are what enabled Russia to weather Ukraine's 2023 counteroffensive. Our allies in Europe could better support such a strategy as well. While some European countries have provided considerable resources, the burden of military support has thus far fallen heaviest on the United States. By committing to a defensive strategy, Ukraine can preserve its precious military manpower, stop the bleeding, and provide time for negotiations to commence. But this would require both American and Ukrainian leadership to accept that Mr. Zelensky's stated goals for the war, a return to 1991 boundaries, are fantastical. The White House has said time and again that they can't negotiate with President Vladimir Putin of Russia. This is absurd. The Biden administration has no viable plan for the Ukrainians to win this war. The sooner Americans confront this truth, the sooner we can fix this mess and broker for peace. That was from the New York Times. The Math on Ukraine Doesn't Add Up by J.D. Vance, April 12, 2024. The second article is from the Washington Post. The Middle East is on the precipice of the wider war no one wants, by David Ignatius, April 12, 2024. The Biden administration is using every diplomatic and military tool to contain what officials expect will be an imminent Iranian reprisal attack against Israel, in the hope that U.S. pressure can keep the conflict from escalating into a region-wide catastrophe. Call it the Guns of April, though this is hardly a conflagration on the order of World War I. It's a moment that eerily evokes the dynamics of summer 1914, when a war that every power sought to avoid suddenly appeared inevitable, with consequences that no one could predict. Officials hope that any exchange between Iran and Israel will be short. Any conflict between Iran and Israel will be short and contained and won't draw in other powers, but they truly don't know what's ahead. President Biden said on Friday that he expects that Iran will strike Israel sooner rather than later in retaliation for an April 1st attack that killed seven Quds Force operatives in Damascus, Syria. U.S. intelligence has observed signs of Iranian preparation for attack, sources said, and the expectation on Friday was that the strike could happen within 24 to 48 hours. Biden's message to Tehran was, don't. The United States is moving on two tracks to steer this crisis away from what could be a devastating cycle of escalation. On the military front, the United States and Israel are both stressing defenses that could neuter an Iranian attack. But if Iran or its proxies succeed in a major strike, Israeli and U.S. officials have warned that it could trigger an offensive spiral that might eventually involve the United States. Israel has the best air defense system in the world, and U.S. officials hope the Israelis could shoot down Iranian drones, cruise missiles, or ballistic missiles, and the three most likely forms of attack. Israel's defense will be supplemented by anti-missile systems on U.S. destroyers that have been rushed to the region, as well as an aircraft carrier and other forces that are already there. The Biden team warned Iran this week about the danger of overreaching in messages sent through the Swiss embassy in Tehran. Administration officials also asked diplomats from China, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and Iraq to pass the same signal to Iranian leaders. The Iranians have responded through the Swiss as recently as Wednesday that they don't want a confrontation with the United States. Tehran has sent the same message through China and other nations that have been passing messages. Iran has to respond, but it will be contained, is how one source described the Iranian messages that have been sent through diplomatic channels. But U.S. officials worry that these reassurances might not be reliable, and that once direct conflict begins, it could move in unpredictable and dangerous ways. The tension within the administration was palpable Friday as the window opened for expected Iranian action. The wider war that the White House has sought to avoid since Hamas's October 7th terrorist attack and Israel's devastating response seemed possible within hours. "Praying that things stay calm," one Israeli official messaged me. "Israel lives under the constant threat of missile attack, so this isn't a unique threat. And Israel and Iran have been waging a covert war of assassinations and sabotage for years. But for Israelis, it's an ominous moment." The Biden administration has assumed since the Damascus attack that some form of Iranian retaliation was inevitable, but it has hoped that Tehran would limit its response because of fears that direct Israeli or U.S. attacks could destabilize the region. As Kerem Sadjapur of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace explains, Iranian leaders know they have a dilemma in weighing retaliation. If they do too little, they lose face, but if they do too much, they could lose their heads. To underline the military risks that Iran could face if it mounts a major attack, General Michael E. Kurilla, the head of U.S. Central Command, visited Israel this week. CENTCOM stages regular exercises with Israel Defense Forces to demonstrate how U.S. military power could backstop Israel in the event of a regional conflict. Though a show of military muscle has been part of the U.S. messaging strategy, there has also been intense use of behind-the-scenes diplomatic channels. After Damascus, Iran messaged through the Swiss channel that the United States was responsible for the attack, according to knowledgeable sources. The administration promptly responded through the Swiss, denying any U.S. role and saying that Washington hadn't been aware of Israeli plans. U.S. diplomatic contact with Iran to contain the war in Gaza has included face-to-face meetings. In January, Brett McGurk, the Middle East director for the National Security Council, met in Oman with Ali Bagheri Khani, Iran's deputy foreign minister. The meeting was suggested by Oman, which has often acted as an intermediary between the two countries. McGurk warned his Iranian counterpart at that meeting that if Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen continued their attacks against shipping in the Red Sea, the U.S. Navy would retaliate. Another Houthi attack came the night after their meeting, and the United States delivered on its warning with a military campaign that has continued with almost daily CENTCOM strikes. The Biden administration believes it has restored deterrence by attacking Iranian proxies in Iraq and Syria that had been targeting U.S. forces. Officials say these proxy attacks against American targets stopped after a February missile strike on Baghdad that killed a commander of Kataib Hezbollah, who had planned attacks against U.S. troops. Administration officials keep preaching the gospel of de-escalation of the war in Gaza and other regional violence. The White House hopes in this latest crisis, too, that once Iran has punched back, the tide of violence will ebb. But on Friday, no one appeared to be heeding that message, and a dangerous new round seemed set to begin. That was from the Washington Post. The Middle East is on the precipice of the wider war no one wants, by David Ignatius, April 12, 2024. The next article is from National Review, J.D. Vance's Logic of Surrender, by Noah Rothman, April 12, 2024. Vance may believe the country he serves in Congress is a spent force, but the rest of America should not. Senator J.D. Vance took his ongoing campaign against the effort to bolster Ukraine's defense to the New York Times opinion pages on Friday. There, he issued the latest of his evolving rationales for acquiescing to Moscow's territorial demands in Europe, because he's one of the more articulate advocates for the restoration of anti-American spheres of influence around the globe. His argument deserves to be read and rebutted in full. President Biden wants the world to believe that the biggest obstacle facing Ukraine is Republicans and our lack of commitment to the global community. This is wrong. Ukraine's challenge is not the GOP, it's math. It is worth noting at the outset that Vance's view that Ukraine's cause is lost, with or without America's support, is not a dispassionate conclusion arrived at following a careful review of the facts on the ground. No such analysis was possible on the very day Moscow embarked on the second invasion of Ukraine, which occasioned a statement from Vance advocating American neutrality, with denunciations of Ukraine itself, a corrupt nation run by oligarchs, the Cheney Republicans he dislikes, and the foreign policy professionals who have blundered their way through crisis after crisis. I gotta be honest with you, I don't really care what happens to Ukraine one way or another, Vance famously remarked in the days before the onset of the worst war on the European continent since 1945. Both of these statements sidestep the question of Ukraine's relation to U.S. interests in favor of his contention that America didn't have the bandwidth or wherewithal to punish Russian aggression. That's worth recalling ahead of the argument Vance presents to Times readers as a more in sorrow revelation. $60 billion is a fraction of what it would take to turn the tide in Ukraine's favor. But this is not just a matter of dollars. Fundamentally, we lack the capacity to manufacture the amount of weapons Ukraine needs us to supply to win the war. Since the start of the conflict, the United States has gone to great lengths to ramp up production of 155mm shells. We've roughly doubled our capacity and can now produce 360,000 per year, less than a tenth of what Ukraine says it needs. The administration's goal is to get this to 1.2 million, 30% of what's needed by the end of 2025. This would cost the American taxpayers dearly while yielding an unpleasantly familiar result, failure abroad. That's a disturbing verdict, not just for Ukraine's sake, but for America's national security. Vance is correct that Ukraine has been forced to ration artillery shells due in part to the delays in delivering ordnance that Vance himself helped orchestrate. Meanwhile, Moscow's stocks have been replenished by anti-American powers such as North Korea and Russia has shifted its economy to a war footing, juicing its GDP artificially with government spending devoted exclusively to the manufacture of bullets, bombs, and weapons platforms. So Kiev is at a grave disadvantage, but not an insurmountable one, particularly because Russia's artillery strength has been greatly diminished since the outset of this war. That drop has forced the Russian military to rely on meat assaults, waves of troops to overwhelm Ukrainian defenses. In the protracted fight for the town of Avdiivka in eastern Ukraine, Veronika Melkozarova and Eva Hartog wrote for Politico earlier this year, "This is a target-rich environment for a properly equipped force." One would think that anyone who reached Vance's conclusion that the United States cannot meet the threats it faces abroad would therefore resolve to address America's deficiencies. Such calls are absent from his op-ed, perhaps in part because the Ukraine aid bill he helped block was designed to revitalize America's domestic defense industrial base. Nearly $35 billion would have been appropriated for the replenishment of Defense Department stocks transferred to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, funds devoted wholly to U.S.-based arms manufacturers. Billions more would have gone to the U.S. submarine manufacturing sector, the procurement and production of artillery and air defense ordnance, the manufacture of sophisticated munitions components and systems to counter unmanned aerial vehicles, to name just a handful of the legislation's priorities. Vance helped scuttle that initiative, and now he denounces the effects of his own advocacy. He also veers wildly away from the logical conclusions of his own outlook into a moral case against helping Ukraine. Proponents of American aid to Ukraine have argued that our approach has been a boon to our economy, creating jobs here in the factories that manufacture weapons. But our national security interests can be, and often are, separate from our economic interests. The notion that we should prolong a bloody and gruesome war because it's been good for American business is grotesque. We can and should rebuild our industrial base without shipping its products to a foreign conflict. This bewildering claim ignores the desperation with which Ukrainians seek American support for their war of national survival, and it dismisses the concerns of America's menaced partners abroad, like Taiwan, which is lobbying with increasing concern on Ukraine's behalf. They're right to worry. This logic could, and I submit absolutely will, be used to justify Americans' hesitancy in support of Taipei, should the Chinese Communist Party attempt to subsume the island nation into the People's Republic of China by force. In the meantime, the 2 million Americans who work in the defense sector will have to find contentment in the fact that their idleness fits with J.D. Vance's preferred moral framework. He continues, "Take the Patriot missile system, our premier air defense weapon. It's of such importance in this war that Ukraine's foreign minister has specifically demanded them. That's because in March alone, Russia reportedly launched over 3,000 guided aerial bombs, 600 drones, and 400 missiles at Ukraine. To fend off these attacks, the Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky and others have indicated they need thousands of Patriot interceptors per year. The problem is this: the United States only manufactures 550 every year. If we pass the supplemental aid package currently being considered in Congress, we could potentially increase annual production to 650, but that's still less than a third of what Ukraine requires." Vance goes on to address the threat to Taiwan in the same terms, noting that the U.S. has delayed delivery of $900 million worth of Patriots to Taipei because they are needed elsewhere. This is a valid concern, but the senator appears to believe the problem is intractable, a belief that does not make the demand for new Patriots somehow disappear. As the logic of demand would suggest, suppliers are scrambling to meet it. Contractors like Boeing and Lockheed are engaged in a crash capital investment program, building massive new facilities, funding sub-tier suppliers to mitigate supply chain disruptions, and cranking out Patriot missiles at a breakneck pace. They are doing so in anticipation that eventually the Pentagon will one day fund missile production increases. The service needs supplemental funding. Defense News reported this week, in order to ramp up capability like the PAC-3 MSE weapon, noting the pending supplemental request to replenish American stockpiles of weapons and equipment sent to Ukraine includes $750 million to help Lockheed increase capacity by more than 100 a year over its current capacity. Again, Vance has put his finger on the challenges, but he seems to suggest they are unresolvable. They're not. At this point, the senator presumes to speak for the average Ukrainian soldier who he appears to posit wants nothing more than to surrender to the Russian forces, who are engaged in a campaign of brutality, ethnic cleansing, and subjugation in the territories they occupy, the like of which has not been seen in Europe in generations. The average Ukrainian soldier is roughly 43 years old, and many soldiers have already served 2 years at the front, with few, if any, opportunities to stop fighting. After 2 years of conflict, there are some villages with almost no men left. The Ukrainian military has resorted to coercing men into service, and women have staged protests to demand the return of their husbands and fathers after long years of service at the front. This newspaper reported one instance in which the Ukrainian military attempted to conscript a man with diagnosed mental disability. Many in Washington seem to think that hundreds of thousands of young Ukrainians have gone to war with a song in their heart and are happy to label any thought to the contrary Russian propaganda. But major newspapers on both sides of the Atlantic are reporting that the situation on the ground in Ukraine is grim. It is fair to worry that Ukraine cannot field enough soldiers to beat back the Russian onslaught. Though Vance's hostility toward the country's draconian conscription policies does not extend to Moscow's even more ruthless draft. Kiev has recently lowered the mobilization age from 27 to 25 to address manpower shortages. Nevertheless, the invaluable Institute for the Study of War finds that the foremost obstacle to forming new combat-ready units is the shortage of weapons and ordnance, not manpower. ISW continues to assess that Western-provided material continues to be the greatest declining factor for the Ukrainian military's ability to restore and augment its combat power. The notion that there is some popular resistance in Ukraine to its war effort is also unsupported. Morale in the country has declined as the straits imposed on it have grown more dire. But a February survey of Ukrainians found 2/3 of all responding wanted to continue all-out resistance until it recaptures its territory. Despite some fatigue among Ukrainians, that figure is more or less consistent with polling in the country from the onset of Russia's war. Vance opposes the provision of the material Ukraine needs now because he insists that the United States lacks the industrial capacity necessary to provide for its embattled partner. He concludes with a full-throated argument in defense of the proposition to which he has adhered even before the shooting commenced, that Ukraine should be compelled to surrender. By committing to a defensive strategy, Ukraine can preserve its precious military manpower, stop the bleeding, and provide time for negotiations to commence. But this would require both American and Ukrainian leadership to accept that Mr. Zelensky's stated goal for the war, a return to 1991 boundaries, are fantastical. The White House has said time and again that they can't negotiate with President Vladimir Putin of Russia. This is absurd. The Biden administration has no viable plan for the Ukrainians to win this war. The sooner Americans confront this truth, the sooner we can fix this mess and broker for peace. Vance has previously outlined what his vision of peace means. What's in America's best interest is to accept Ukraine is going to have to cede some territory to the Russians, he told CNN last December. Why was it therefore not in Israel's best interest to surrender its territory when it was vastly outnumbered and outgunned in 1973? Why should Israel continue to resist an Iran-led onslaught on all sides today? Must the Taiwanese people be consigned to prolonged suffering and slaughter at the hands of the Chinese merely because the U.S. has convinced itself that free commercial navigation of the South China Sea is in its interests? How many more American investments in the hegemony that was blessedly bequeathed to us would be sacrificed if Vance's logic becomes American policy? Fortunately, more Americans reject Vance's position than agree with it, and for good reason. Land-hungry despots are never sated by their first conquest. We don't need to look to history for evidence of that. We need only to look to Vladimir Putin, whose appetite has only grown with the acquisition of this or that or the other tract of territory. The abandonment of Ukraine would fracture the Atlantic Alliance, leaving its more exposed members on the periphery in a state of anxiety that could lead to freelancing, a prospect that carries infinitely more danger of resulting in a conflagration than a united front led and maintained by the United States. Vance and other critics of the Biden administration are justified in their frustration with Kiev's inability to outline a clear theory of what victory would look like, and they're correct to speculate that is because no such theory exists. Though survival as a primary objective demands no such theory, Ukraine's more strategic objectives certainly do. But degrading Russia's ability to reignite a frozen conflict in Ukraine at a time of its choosing is preferable to gifting them such a conflict at a time when Moscow is committing all its resources to this fight. Ukraine's cause remains a sound investment of the 2% of the federal budget America has committed to it. It not only advances our geopolitical interests, but it has also led to a revitalization of America's vital defense capabilities. Vance's op-ed performs the noble service of articulating the logic of retreat, not just from our priorities in Europe, but from everywhere else on the globe. He's clever enough not to say as much outright, but his fellow retrenchment advocates possessed of his outlook, but not his discretion, have made it clear. Their problem is not so much with Ukraine, but America, its post-war obligations, its power, its alliance structure, and most of all, the Americans who believe in the U.S.-led world order stands athwart their domestic and spending priorities. Vance may believe the country he serves in Congress is a spent force, but the rest of America should not. The world's freedom-loving people certainly don't, and so long as that is the case, the logic of surrender articulated in his op-ed will struggle to find a constituency. Noah Rothman is a senior writer at National Review. He is the author of The Rise of the New Puritans, Fighting Back Against Progressives, War on Fun and Unjust Social Justice, and The Unmasking of America. That was from National Review, J.D. Vance's Logic of Surrender, by Noah Rothman, April 12, 2024. That's all the time we have for the News and Perspective today. I'm Ross Bowers for the Virginia Voice. This program is on the air daily at 3 o'clock p.m. and 6:30 a.m. You can also listen anytime on demand at www.virginiavoice.org.